And we existed by collaboration with a whole number of people that helped us from the very beginning to start the National Resource Center for American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian Elders. And we're housed in the University of Alaska Anchorage and College of Health and Social Welfare. And so we're in our seventh year. North Dakota's been there like over 20 years. And then our newest partner, newest resource center, is University of Hawaii Manoa. And they're doing really, really great work addressing the issues of Native Hawaiians and Samoans. And we, of course, had this total Native American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian Elders, and the undersecretary, Hupakina Carbonell, said, Alaska is big enough in itself. Just concentrate on your people in Alaska. And so we did, and then North Dakota takes care of Law 48. So moving on, I guess I just hit this. Okay, of course, we get our funding for the Administration on Aging. And the direction that the RFP that came out of the Administration on Aging was training and listening sessions where the people that work in Title VI programs would be there for various kinds of training that relate to their work to provide nutritious meals for our elders throughout the country. And then at the end, they would have the elders from all over the country, Lower 48, Alaska, to express what it is that they wanted at these listening sessions. And one of the things that they talked about is that they wanted to address culturally relevant programs in health services. They wanted to be sure that some of the professionals that come to take care of us know something about us. But they also were concerned about the other issues of the hard topics to talk about, things like elderly treatment, things like suicide, and all the other ills of our society that we're struggling to overcome. And so, moving on. And then just to give you a sense of how big Alaska is, you heard the Jean Cheryl Easley talk very briefly at the opening how big that is. And we have some of our people that live at the very extreme end of the Yucatan Island chain. And with the distances, sometimes people that are going in for emergency medical treatment in our central hospital die along the way, unfortunately. And of course, sometimes they're weathered in and they get stuck in those islands, and so that's another problem. But then, of course, the cost of airfare is also another challenge for our people who kind of programs, what funds we do get out of the federal government. And so we have all these distances to contend with. We also have geography, we also have weather through the different seasons. And then we have all these different cultures that are here, the cultural groups here. And I'd like to say that we truly are a united nation. Nations up there in Alaska, we have the Aleut in green, and then we have the central Yupik for you, and then the Aleut Sukhumvit. These two are very close together, and I can understand the people from Kodiak Island and Crispian Sound. And they are also the same language group, but we've been separated so long that we barely understand each other. And then the Inuit are over here, they're actually Inuit, and then of course the Galahad women. And then of course we have the 23 Nagaday family of languages, and there's 11 of them in Alaska. And then the EF people over here, we lost our last living speaker. How long ago was it? About a year now?
2 years.
2 years ago, and I had a chance to work with her. And for her to say, you can hear the kind of pain that she has of not being able to speak to any of her own people because they're still there, but they lost their language. She did get a permanent calling card from Michael Krause, who's an linguist at the University of Fairbanks, so she can at least chat with this fellow who did pretty decent work. But of course, we also have the African Title Sentient in Southeast Alaska. And so that's a mixture of our people. And I think that one of the issues that relate, that united us as a people for our native land claims, where the Law 48, is that the only positive thing about boarding school is that we got to know each other in boarding school as individuals. And when I first went to Wrangell in 1955, I'd never heard of the Title Sentient. I'd never heard of witch kings. I'd just heard of Indians. And I didn't know that much about Yoga. Excuse me, I was trying to silence this a little while ago. I did that a while back out of convocation. It was very embarrassing. So anyway, we got to know each other from that experience. And of course, that has its own. And then all of these slides from slide 6 to 17 were developed by our collaborators, Dr. Kathy Graves, who is Alaska Native researcher, a brand new PhD in social work, which will work looking at the dynamics of how young Alaska Natives assume the position of leadership with their PhD. And then the other person that worked with that is Louise Shavings, who is Chupik, one of my relatives from New York Island, recently at MSW. And the third person that worked with her on this project was Koki Gwynn, who's at the Baskin. And so it was a collaborative effort from the very beginning. And the three ladies that I talked about had worked for had gotten a grant from the Institute of Circumpolar Health on two wonderful projects called, one was called Alaska Natives into Psychology, and the other one is Alaska Native Science and Research into Health. They were looking for a project. They were trying to train Alaska Natives and non-Natives in respectful research of Alaska people. And so we just happened to come along at just the right time. And I had taken our dean and several and one of my research students and spent almost several weeks contacting all the regional health centers in our Alaska. We have 13 of them that represent all of the 229 recognized tribes. And so from the very beginning, we also established a memorandum agreement with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium that represents those 13 regional centers. So we had permission from the very beginning. And then with the Elder Advisor Committee, and each of those regional centers selected their own. It was amazing who they selected, because they were the most experienced, the most dedicated of our elders and most respected elders that we had in this group of elder, what we call the Alaska Native Elder Advisory Health Committee. And we meet, we first met three times a year, we now meet twice a year. And then that organization, that advisory committee, advises the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and we're discussing that the main board itself really has a lot of respect for the advice that comes out of the elders. And then they, of course, also advise the National Resource Center as well. And so we're taking a quick look at the cultural holocaust that has happened, first with the Russian experience. It happened from the beginning of 1741 when they first gazed upon our land. They were, I think, friendly in one sense, is that they at least the missionary side, Russian Orthodox side, but actually allowed Native people to learn to read and write their language in the Russian surroundings. So at least they did that. But on the business side, and that was really kind of the very harsh piece of the colonial dynamics of harvesting the fur seal and the sea otter as well, then they actually enslaved the aliens along. They discovered that the Russians themselves couldn't catch the fur seal and the sea otter very well. So they actually just took these men that knew how to do it and just enslaved them. And then later on, when the United States took over, they actually continued that slavery with the Aleuts on the, like say, on the harvesting of the fur seal on St. Paul, St. George Island. And they actually were in danger. They were actually, they had to get permission to leave the island, they had to get permission to get married. They didn't pay them real money, but these little chicks that they got that they could take to the store to get their food. And then there, of course, during World War II, the United States, in its well-intentioned fear that they could be captured by the Japanese, took them, all the elders, or all the people from the Aleutian chain, gave them one day to get their clothing or what have you, got on the ship, and shipped them to Southeast Alaska in abandoned, old, unheated canneries. And so you can guess what happened to them in that kind of condition. A lot of them, unfortunately, passed away. And then there finally was a bill that came out in recognition of what the government had done in order to really kind of pay back to the average people the suffering that they had incurred. And then, of course, we're looking at the Great Death. Of course, a lot of you know that law, same thing. We had, when I was born on Nelson Island, there were like 10 of us that were born that year, and that Catholic priest that came back said there was only 3 of us out of that first 1 year later because there was no medical treatment. And of course, the whole idea of forced acculturation, of course, like many low 48 Indians, forced to speak English. My first experience in first grade was to be hit with a wooden ruler because I was speaking, and I didn't speak English, just a few more words. Then I spoke in Gatchin again. And so finally I said, I'm afraid I've been speaking my language for a while. I didn't do it in school, but when I went home, I was surrounded by the language, so I was fortunate that I never did lose that language, the whole notion of that language deprivation. And however, with all the turmoil that has happened, our people are beginning to find a way to try to heal ourselves from all of those negative dynamics that I've kind of mentioned. And I think all of you probably know a bit about what some of those are. And then, of course, we're looking at the boarding school area, the missionization. And one of the things that related the missionary work was that a Presbyterian minister by the name of Shelton Jackson was very astute politically, where he went to the Congress and said Alaska needed to have, you know, schools for the native children. So he formed the Northwest Council on Churches, took a blank map of Alaska. I read this article inward studies in from Canada. For that, he took a black map of Alaska, and then they said, oh, okay, Presbyterian will form around Barrow, Baptists will go around Kodiak Island, Covenant churches will go around Newman Creek, Episcopalians may be right in the middle, and then they just went on. They didn't invite the Russians, nor did they invite the Catholics, but they went ahead and divvied up the land, and then divvied up the area, rather. And then there's a story in that same article, that research story, I need to find it, where it said that two regions need to switch areas for some reason. And so they did, and so they issued these little cards. You are no longer, I'm having to guess too, I was remembering the article as well. You are no longer Baptist, you are no Presbyterian. And then Sheldon Jackson was a bit astute in the fact that he was able to convince Congress to send these various churches to come to Alaska to teach school. And of course, they had their own agenda with Christianity and whatever, but one of the things that he did, being really quite a politician, was that in order for them to provide as a church, they actually were able to amend the Homestead Act to where some of these churches that have schools up there would get anywhere from 100 acres, 150 to 300 acres of land. When I was on Kodiak Island here on the Green Island, the traditional island of the Tsuchat people from a farm that were there, and they were in their building, and they had a little map for the island. They said, oh, you can go all over here, but you can't go over here. So we said, well, why? This Baptist land. So when I talked to some of the elders on the mainland, rather than Korea City itself, and who bought the land, they said, we always wondered why those Baptists got that land, how they got that land. So today, to this day, some of those churches that started still have land in their name. And so, but the Moravian Church in Bethel actually did give back some of the land for people had built homes, or at least they did that. But there's still a lot of those churches that still have property from the original, the changes of the Homestead Act. So, and so with the whole idea of knowing that you lost your land, it is just painful. You can't hunt like you used to. We were cultural people. Of course, the Great Death, it just brings about all kinds of stories in terms. I grew up watching some of my relatives and elders. I could see the blood bubbling out of their mouths and noses because of the hemorrhaging in their lungs. It was a horrible thing to see. And then some of the ones that were fortunate enough to be sent to the sanitariums would be gone for several years, and they would be very different people when they came back. And of course, you'd seen this phrase before, which was kind of the idea of the, and then the work of the devil idea, that was always something that, it was the work of the devil in terms of what our religion was, but it was their devil, not ours. And then cultural disruption, of course, assimilation, of course, language deprivation. And then, but we're trying to work to get that back. It takes a little bit of work. The immersion process is so wonderful, as you know, when you were babies, you were surrounded by language, and that's how you learned your language. You didn't have to sit and study, you weren't aware of it, you just heard it over and over again. And that's the beauty of immersion. And then, of course, there are the beginnings of wonderful healing programs, and we're starting sometimes from ground zero, but we have wonderful people like Christine Courtney and others that really do have a caring heart and are respectful for our traditions and learn to listen to our elders. And then, so we're looking at that whole cultural value idea. And then elders, of course, we're concerned about the entire community. So a lot of our programs that we developed, although we got funded from the Administration on Aging to concentrate on the elders, we make the argument that we have to include the youth as well. And of course, they wanted to live with their family members because in some medical places that require highly technical licensed healthcare programs like respiratory dialysis and things like that don't exist in rural Alaska. And the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium that Christine worked for is doing amazing things to try and resolve that issue. And then, of course, the removing elders from their villages has negative consequences, that cultural knowledge that they have leaves with them, and of course our children lose a lot of that. Of course, Native food, when I was at Our Lady Compassion Care, all those elders that were there from all over Alaska, that was the very first things that they said when I was there, is that they missed their native food. They're tired of hamburger and spaghetti and pizza, things like that. So we were able to get at least some fish that they can occasionally have, and we even got a roadkill for moose, and so they have a celebration. Then occasionally we had somebody that came in and did fry bread. That was something else that they enjoyed. And then they wanted their healthcare workers to understand their cultural language customs. In our first meeting with our project, it was held in Juneau in the country. And I remember that the Thiggets have a really very structured ritual of communicating, a really structured organization, loyalties of raven and beaver. And then even when they think to themselves that they are approaching a village, they would actually, as their canoes were being rowed across, they would actually chat to the people that they were visiting in terms of greeting them, and there would be a verbal exchange of respect and permission to meet each other. And so that's the first thing that I had to do in Juneau. And that fellow that I taught that said that you need to go talk to that elder there. And then I went to see him from what I wanted to do. I had called once before, but I wanted to make sure that we had that permission early at least. And so he gave us permission, and we had our meeting. And then the men were out getting ready to do something to do with fishing. And so they were there, but all the women were there. A handful of Thinkers women. And I think there was one sister. And then they introduced themselves all the way around. And then when the last lady talked, she mentioned that her ancestors were from Angoon. And so with what little history I know of the Thinkit Indians, the village of Angoon was bombarded by the U.S. Navy in 1822, and they attempted to destroy the village. There was one of their medicine people got killed in the Thinkit tradition at this concept called Atfu, that which is owned, kind of like a copyright. So whenever things get together and they're getting ready to dance, they said, well, the next dance that we're going to perform was given to us by so-and-so, by so-and-so, or we bought it from them, kind of thing. They didn't quite follow through. They did, apparently, the Navy did give them some blankets, but they didn't get that important her apology saying, "We're sorry that it happened." They just never did it. And so they shot up that village, and a handful of them did run into the trees and survive. So after the lady left, the other villagers that heard about it came by and helped them to survive. And that was at the very first meeting that we had with our National Resource Center that we called the Voices of Our Elders. And one of the things that was also revealing of the cross-cultural dynamics and kind of what happened, this one of the ladies that organized it told the story that he had taken his very ill father to the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Center there in Juneau. And there was a brand new doctor, you know, asking him questions. And one of the questions was, "How far can you walk?" And then this lady describes that the father just, you know, you could see that he was trying to get up and he just barely got up and he just almost fell, but he finally stood up and he said, "I can walk a quarter of a mile." Well, that would have been a quarter of a mile. The lady was interior because he could barely walk across the room. Because in the Hebrew tradition, you withstand pain regardless of whether you're hurting that bad. You just withstand pain. So those are the kind of things that we began to hear from the elders themselves, and that's why we call it the Voices of Our Elders. And there were many other concepts that they told us about. And then we kind of broke down into various cultural groups because we had, of course, we are different groups of people. We have our own language, we have our own values and what have you, ways of living. They were talking about cultural ways linked to historical trauma, and then need to get back to traditional ways of childbearing, and then this whole idea that elders look at the child and they know when that child is ready to hear and learn. So they, before that, they were kind of permissive things, kind of let them do what they want to do, within reason, of course. But then as they observe the child, that's, I guess they look at the gaze or something, when that young child is ready to hear, that's when they begin the story, that's when they begin the survival stories, they begin creation stories and what have you. And that's what they were talking about here. Then, of course, Southeastern Alaska, I think it had a sensium, right off the bat. I left that there for a reason, and they didn't like the word Southeastern Elders because they were so proud. "No, we're not just Southeastern Elders. I'm Clinton, and I'm not Haida, and I'm not sensium." But there's a lot of intermarriage going on now. So we got a note right away. Then, of course, they have this notion of respect, and then the whole idea of respect and reciprocity and balance. Because in the Thinker tradition, and since the Amnashwakaida, you have the ravens on one side and the eagles on the other. And so if your mother was a raven, all your children were raven. And then if you were eagle, it was the same thing. But it was through the mother, raised the raven. And when I was attending a wellness conference, international wellness conference in Minneapolis, St. Paul, there was a Native American fellow who was signing. He knew the international signing that a lot of people knew in the world, but then he also knew the Indian, Native American signing. And they showed a documentary of 16 tribal leaders who couldn't speak each other's language, but they could sign. They showed you how to communicate. They probably thank you too. And so after he got done with Guavera, I asked the interpreter who could hear, who also interpreted the hearing and then sign language back and forth, asked him, "My wife is saying that she's Raven Beaver. How do I sign Raven Beaver?" So it went like this. That's bird. This is black. So when you do this, that's Raven. And then the beaver part is like this. So that's Raven Beaver. So later on, I went to see him, and I don't want to show off, because I want to go back and show my grandson and my wife, and it's Raven Beaver, that I know the sign language. So I went up to him and says, "Well, I remember just going to go like this, and go like this, and then I thought." Then he looked at me, and he looked around, and he came over and whispered in my ear. He said, "That last part that you did this way, you don't want to do that, because people might misunderstand you because it has other connotations." And so I asked him, "So what's the other connotation?" He says, "You need to take biology." And I said, "Okay, I'll take biology." Kind of thing. And then, so later on at that conference, we all had a comment to make about the conference itself that we had. And then what they did was, and So Rial had to make a comment, so I told that story, and then I ended with, you know, about this part and versus this, and then the congregation part that people might misunderstand what you're signing. So I said, all right, you lawyers, be very careful how you use your hand, because somebody might misinterpret what you're saying. You're going to have to be glad. And that's one of the things that we had that survived is that our humor was always there. The Athabascan elders were amazing. The whole idea of honoring elders and communal learning. And then they had all these wonderful potlatches. That's the one thing that I missed when I left the University of Alaska Fairbanks, because the elders took me in. And I had the honor of being able to have some of those elders in my class for 5 weeks, where they talked to our students for an hour and a half. And then each of those elders met with each student individually, where they got a one-on-one discussion of culture, and the student had a chance to ask questions. And at first we had the students just ask the questions that they wanted, and finally the elder said, we're getting tired of hearing the same question. So we asked the elders, what should we do? Oh, they're smart. We said, well, you break up the class, and you break into groups of people, then you would ask that group, the early years, the growing up years, the middle years, then the longer years, and expand the whole lifestyle. So by the end of that semester, the students would write papers on that. We got a fairly complete biography of that elder. Then we submitted that information to the Project 2 class at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where they highlighted an art catalog and archive those stories that we had. And it's a growing living project where family members can send photographs and other stories in the academy. So it's one of those appearances that is really kind of nice that's beginning to happen that we didn't have before. And let me see, how much time do I have? Okay, all the rest is, what I want to do is to quickly show you the three best practices based on the cultural values that, and these were all some of the recommendations, but I wanted to jump to, there are three best practices that came out of our project. Besides, one of them was the Chugach Meet Fatherhood Program. Patrick Anderson, who's an attorney who runs it, told the story of how his father was there but was gone for a good part of the time. He lost his sister to alcoholism. But the father who remarried stayed with the family, although he was dysfunctional with alcoholism, at least they didn't have the kind of problems that the first parent had, so he saw the picture. But it's great to have parent physically there, even though they may sometimes be in dysfunction with alcoholism or something. And so they started the fatherhood program, and Pat Anderson found out there's a national fatherhood initiative, and so they're following through on this program. They're going to basically have the motherhood program. And then I was teaching about what about the grandparents, and so he chuckled and said, we might do that. And this has been successful. And then the Inupiat, over 10 years ago, were concerned about juvenile delinquency in their villages. And so Dr. Kenny Kuba was given an honorary PhD. He saved many lives by what he knew about the Arctic file. They went to talk to these juveniles that got into trouble, and then they would talk about cultural values, and then found out that those juveniles were more afraid of the elders than they were the village EPSOs, village police safety people, as well as the magistrates and judges. So it did work, but it also related to tribal torts, tribal government sovereignty issues. And then ABCP, the Association of Village Council Presidents, of 56 villages, 56 leaders, we didn't have a chief system, but they forced us to have chiefs, which is okay. And so they came up with the idea of competent elders. They identified competent elders, and they had elders in training. And so they would, one of them is Paul John, who is one of my relatives from the Riva from Nelson Island, and he's being honored with an honorary PhD this spring at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, so I'm going to make sure that I'm going to be there. Because he is my relative, and we do honor him that way. And there's one other John that's getting a degree. His daughter is getting a PhD from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in analyzing the dance dynamics of the Greek way. neighborhoods that we saw being developed locally. Our elders are still are beautiful, they're wisdom keepers. And then we're losing them too fast. So we're hoping that a lot of our young people are just going to take photographs and just record regardless, just as long as they have something. It doesn't have to be structured. And so we talked about the Jukebox Project at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Anyway, if you would go down to the website, type in elders.ua.alaska.edu, you'll see our website. It's a work in progress. And so there's a lot of our papers up there, a lot of our projects and our PowerPoints up there, because we use the PowerPoints as training modules, because we're looking at connecting with our Title VI people through business education, value education, and fairness. And so I want to thank you for your attention. I know that we have other presenters, and I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity of chatting with you. I think there'll be a little bit of time later on if you have any questions, but if I don't get a chance to answer your questions, just type in elders.ua.alaska.edu, and even my email is there. But those of you who have good memory, gcharles@ua.alaska.edu. Oh, yeah, I'm a doctor. Thank you very much.